Abengoa Bioenergy is expected to open its plant in Hugoton, Kansas on October 17th of this year, and Grand Bio has been working all year to open its first commercial plant in Alagoas, Brazil. Many other companies have started or are starting cellulosic biofuel projects this year. Ineos Bio in Vero Beach, Florida, DuPont Cellulosic Biofuels in Nevada, Iowa, and Quad County Corn Processors in Galva, Iowa. So these are very key milestones in the commercialization of cellulosic biofuels, something that we've waited on for a long time. We're very excited about, and we're very concerned that the RFS could derail this ongoing commercialization. These projects are creating hundreds of new jobs and generating economic opportunities for rural communities. Cumulatively, the industry has invested billions of dollars and a decade of research and development to reach this pivotal stage. Further expansion of the technology and construction of additional large-scale biorefineries will require billions of dollars more in investment. Excuse me. But in excuse me. Instability in the RFS simply chills needed investment. The proposed rule issued last November by EPA, combined with the ongoing delay in finalizing the 2014 rule, have caused companies to delay decisions and investments in building the next round of biorefineries. The question raised by this policy instability is a basic one for any investor. What is the size of the market for the end product? Two-thirds of this year have passed already, and the question remains unanswered. And that's very unfortunate that EPA and the White House have been so slow. And the proposed rule for 2014 extended the uncertainty about how that question will be answered in future years. Will it continue to be based on our industry's ability to generate fuel and make good on the investment and development of new technology? Or will EPA completely undermine the RFS and base the answer on the oil refining industry's willingness to give up its complete control of the market? I think it's important to note, many of you may have missed it, but last week the Energy Information Agency announced that they have updated the data on actual gasoline consumption in 2013 and projected gasoline consumption in 2014, and it was 2 billion gallons a year higher. I think that that shows that we're not any closer to reaching any so-called blend wall. I don't think we're dealing with fictional fuels here. The only fiction really is the blend wall. So with that, I'd like to introduce our first speaker. Steve Hartig is the General Manager of Licensing for Poet DSM Advanced Biofuels, based in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Poet DSM on September 3rd held a ribbon-cutting event for the Project Liberty in Emmitsburg, Iowa. And they even had the King of the Netherlands visit, which is a very high honor. And Steve is here to give an update on that project, as well as how the delay in establishing this year's rule has impacted future plans for the company. Steve will be followed by Chris Stanley, Executive Vice President, Global Affairs for Abengoa Bioenergy. Abengoa has U.S. headquarters in St. Louis and Washington, D.C., and is in the process of starting up a commercial-scale facility in Hugoton, Kansas. Abengoa is an international company that has operated a demonstration cellulosic biorefinery in Valencia, Spain, for several years now. And then wrapping up will be Vani Estes, Managing Director, U.S., for Grand Bio, which is headquartered in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Grand Bio is in the process of starting up its first cellulosic biofuel facility in Brazil, licensing several technologies that have been demonstrated in Italy as well as in the U.S. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Steve Hartig to say a few words about Poet DSM's venture. Steve?
Thanks, Brent, and thanks all for joining. This is an exciting time in the cellulosic biofuels industry, and as Brent mentioned, and a number of you on the line observed face-to-face, we had our grand opening 2 weeks ago for Project Liberty in Emmitsburg. We're working now to ramp that plant up to its full capacity of 25 million gallons, and right now we're going through various optimization of the production processes and producing a small scale, but that'll be ramping up over the coming months. before long, there'll be multiple plants operational in the U.S., Brazil, Europe, and the not-so-distant future China from various companies. It's also true that some plants have had challenges in startup, which is normal in new innovative areas such as this. Scaling up biochemical processes from a pilot level to a very large scale is challenging. When we look at cellulosic ethanol on an overall basis, we see it as attractive to the U.S. and the world, first of all, because it brings economic benefits to rural communities. By bringing about 100 direct and indirect jobs, we purchase crop residues in the range of $20 million per year and tax revenues of over $1 million a year. On the environmental side, cellulosic ethanol brings a 80 to 90% reduction in greenhouse gases when compared to gasoline using the EPA's GREET model. And finally, ethanol in general supports energy security. Despite the increased oil production in the U.S., we're still importing about 5 million barrels of oil per day, often from countries that are not really our allies. Looking at our business model beyond Liberty is to work with companies on a global basis to license our technology and then work closely with them to build and start up the plant. We're also working with external investors such as venture capitalists, retirement funds, and banks to bring money in to invest in the plants. Our primary target in the U.S. is to co-locate plants next to corn ethanol plants to take advantage of site synergies and to export green energy from the cellulosic plant to the corn plant. The ongoing discussions on the RFS concern us in a number of ways. First of all, simply the fact that there is an extended lengthy discussion brings uncertainty, and no investor wants to invest in an uncertain environment, particularly given that this is a new technology. Beyond that, it was always known from the start that the RFS would lead to a need to go above E10, with exact timing depending on overall gasoline demand and the ramp-up of cellulosic ethanol. Many oil companies are today acting surprised, but they knew the math and just put it off to force the issue. If ethanol volume in the U.S. is limited, that means that every cellulosic ethanol plant will force either the closure of a corn ethanol plant or exports. This will lead to an oversupply, driving prices for ethanol down, making the value proposition very difficult. This also makes for interesting discussions with corn ethanol plants about co-location. Today we're at the start, like oil was 160 years ago or corn ethanol was 40 years ago. And what we want to do is move this industry forward to be the success we're confident it can be. We have invested as companies, as POET and DSM, hundreds of millions of dollars in this and are convinced cellulosic ethanol will be a key part of our future energy mix. For the EPA and the administration, we ask them to stick with the principle in the law of the RFS, which is promoting the use of U.S.-produced fuels made from cellulosic feedstocks and push through the artificial blend wall. Thank you for your time, and I'll pass it over to Chris now.
Okay, Chris, take it away.
Thanks, Brent, and thanks to everyone on the line for participating today. First of all, let me apologize if you happen to hear airplane noise. With the wind in this direction, my office in Arlington is right in the flight path for DCA, so I'll try and stay on mute except when I'm talking. Bottom line, we have all said for some time in this industry that 2014 would be a banner year for cellulosic ethanol, and there's certainly satisfaction in this projection now being proven to be true. On behalf of Abengoa in particular, I'm pleased to report on our progress that we've made in commercializing our cellulosic ethanol technology and in starting operations at our 25 million gallon per year facility in Hugoton, Kansas. As most of you have heard before, Abengoa has been working on perfecting this technology for over 10 years. We've scaled up this facility and this proprietary process through laboratory and bench plants, through pilot plant scale, demonstration plant scale, and now all the way to full commercial scale production at Hugoton. We've developed our own proprietary enzymes, and we've dramatically increased the efficiency and yields of the process to the point that we can take multiple low-value feedstocks, starting with agricultural residues at Hugoton, but soon to include municipal solid waste from urban landfills at other locations. We can turn those feedstocks into a valuable, low-cost, and high-octane fuel. This technology will provide a tremendous economic benefit to the local economies where the fuel is produced, and will also provide a benefit to the end consumer by lowering the cost of fuel in general. We've now completed construction of this new Hugoton facility, and we expect to begin plant operations within the next several days. We've announced a grand opening, as Brent mentioned, for the facility on October 17th in Hugoton, and we certainly would like to invite any of you on the call that would like to attend to do so. The event will be held from 11 to 1 in Hugoton, with tours and media opportunities from 1 to 4 with VIP speakers. Our facility will pay $17 million annually to purchase 300,000 tons of agricultural residues from local farmers, and we'll convert that into biomass into 25 million gallons of cellulosic ethanol and lots of renewable electric power. This facility will be self-sufficient, providing all of its own steam and electricity needs, as well as producing enough additional electricity to be sold to the local power grid. As Brent stated, one of the biggest drivers in the development and implementation of this technology in the U.S. has been the Renewable Fuel Standard. This 2007 law is the primary reason that the U.S. leads the world in the development of second-generation biofuel technologies, and it's the primary reason for our construction of our new facility in Hugoton. The EPA has a responsibility to adopt regulations to implement this law, and the EPA has historically been very supportive of the biofuels community. However, now that production of second-generation ethanol is now being commercialized, the EPA has revealed a misunderstanding of the purpose of the RFS in their volume proposals that were released just last November. These volume proposals were, for the first time, substantially below the statutory numbers for most categories of biofuels. Perhaps more importantly, they implied that infrastructure concerns were the basis for those reductions. After receiving hundreds of thousands of comments on that proposed rule, the EPA has now indicated that it will revise its proposal to substantially increase the volumes, and we trust that this will in fact happen and that the final rule, which has now been submitted to OMB for review, will be more positive. We also hope that EPA will positively address the issue of the methodology that they have used in proposing those volumes, and recognize that infrastructure issues are not an appropriate consideration in determining these annual volumes. In fact, a primary purpose of the RFS was to encourage the increased use of biofuels beyond any perceived infrastructure limitations or any anticipated or imaginary blend wall, and to ensure that if investments were made in developing and producing these new fuels, a market for those fuels would exist. Based upon EPA's general support for biofuels, and our expectation of revisions in their 2014 RVO rule, we still see potential for further development of second-generation biofuels in the U.S. However, there's no question that the November proposed rule has had a negative impact on investments of biofuels within the U.S. This proposal signaled a lack of consistent support for the concept of the RFS from the EPA, and this has clearly chilled U.S. investment interest, both from outside investors as well as from within the industry itself. From Abengoa's standpoint, in order to diversify our market risk, we're moving forward with the development of our next second-generation project in San Luis, Brazil. We plan to build a cellulosic hybrid project in Pirassununga, co-located with our existing sugar facility there, in order to take advantage of existing infrastructure and especially the existing source of our own biomass. This project will be similar in size to Hugoton and will utilize the same technology, and we are currently negotiating with equity partners as well as project financing partners in Brazil. Abengoa has extensive plans for future development and implementation of this technology using many different agricultural residues as well as municipal solid waste, as I mentioned before, for our feedstocks. We anxiously await EPA's final rule and are hopeful that it will comply with the law and actively encourage future investment in the U.S. biofuels market. I look forward to questions later, but for now I'll turn it back over to Brent.
Thank you, Chris. And now we'd like to hear from Bonnie Estes.
Thanks, Brent. I work with Grambio, which is a 100% Brazilian company founded in 2011, so a fairly new company. We're currently commissioning a 22 million gallon a year cellulosic ethanol plant in the northeast of Brazil in the state of Alagoas. The plant will run on sugarcane straw, which is the tops and leaves of the sugarcane, and the gas that's left over from the milling of sugarcane. We're developing supply chains from feedstock through production of fuel, so we're working on collecting the straw, which previously was burned and now is collected and not burned, and turning that into the ethanol. Our plan is to export at least half of this fuel from the plant in Alagoas to the U.S. We filed a registration with the EPA and with the state of California for low carbon fuel credit. The company has spent over $200 million in capital on this plant, some of it ours and some of it from a loan from the National Bank of Brazil. And as this is a bit different than the other two U.S. plants, I think the plant is really good for the U.S. in that it's a source of low-carbon fuels into the market. So if you look at why we're doing this and looking at climate change and lowering greenhouse gas emissions, having this plant produce the fuel in Brazil and importing it into the U.S. is helping in the overall reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. It's also proving out a technology. The technology that we're using, there's two plants in the U.S. that are trying to get funding to build in the U.S., and once our plant is up and going smoothly, we'll show that the technology is sound and ready for scale-up. And depending on what happens with the RFS, hopefully the plants in the U.S. will get the funding that they need. And we also buy a lot of products from the U.S. Novozymes is our enzyme supplier, and so we buy our enzymes that are produced in Blair, Nebraska. So there's a lot of economic gain in the U.S. as well from this plant. Our original plan was to build 2 billion liters in production by 2020. And that plan was originally done about a year and a half ago when we were looking at the U.S. and saying there's a lot of value to bring this fuel into the U.S. And for us, it's not a matter of financing. We have the financing, but it's a matter of looking at the stability and the predictability of pricing in the U.S. and what's going on now with the RVOs and not knowing how the RVOs are going to be set in the future. We're really taking a step back and saying, does it make sense for us to build more cellulosic ethanol plants, or should we put our capital to work doing something else? I think importing some of our fuel would prove the viability of the technology, and it also it would help be a primer for getting the fuels adopted and used in the U.S. We were the first company to get our pathway approved by the California Air Resources Board. We're going through the comment period right now, and so just doing that, being a pioneer and getting that pathway done is going to help the other U.S. companies as well. So with that, I'll turn it back to Brent.
Okay, thank you very much for all of our good speakers. And now we'll turn it over to the operator for reporter questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, in order to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. I need to have a question from the line of Rachel Gant.
Yes, is my line open?
Yeah, go ahead, Rachel.
Great. I wanted to find out what impact will the final 2014 RFS cellulosic biofuel RVOs have on your company's specific plants, and also how much fuel does your respective plants plan to produce this year?
Why don't we take that in the order that the speaker spoke, and we'll go Steve, Chris, and Bonnie.
Sure. Well, the particular cellulosic numbers for 2014 is not a huge impact on us. We assume they'll come in close to what they should be, but it's you're talking a part of your production versus this. So it's more important to us, the overall structure of what they come through with it and what's going forward. We're ramping the plant up right now, so I can't give you an exact number, but I can say it'll be in the millions of gallons. But I would say it won't be in the tens of millions of gallons. So that's a bit of a wide range, but we're going through the ramp up.
Chris?
Yeah, from Evan-Goa's standpoint, first of all, the 2014 volume numbers, you know, will have very little short-term impact on us. Like Steve, I believe that, you know, the cellulosic numbers in that rule will probably be, you know, will probably be adequate. There's certainly, you know, potential impact beyond 2014, depending on, you know, the whole rationale question and how they come out on 2015 and subsequent year numbers. But but no short term impacts. In 2014, in and of itself, you know, isn't going to have a big impact on a plant that's already built. For our volumes this year, we do expect to start production literally any day now. And we'll have significant volumes this year. We don't have a specific number that we're publishing, but and it certainly won't be full capacity, you know, from day one. But we certainly expect a ramp-up period. But we do expect to be close to consistent production by, you know, the early part of next year. And like I say, we expect to produce significant gallons this year, again, in the millions.
Yeah, Rachel, I would say the same thing pretty much that the other speakers have said. The numbers this year aren't going to matter that much. We probably won't be exporting any fuel this year, so it's not going to have that big effect on us. And we're hoping to produce fuel any day now. It's gone from in the next couple of weeks to the next couple of days, so we are getting very close, and expect, again, to be producing in the millions, but probably not tens of millions this year as well.
Thank you very much.
Okay, next question, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Eric Lindman.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, this is Eric Lindman.
Yes, it is. The Energy Daily?
Yes, sir.
This morning, the White House announced, the Navy, the Department of Energy, and the Department of Agriculture. The Navy will be buying more than 100 million gallons a year of drop-in advanced biofuels, with production starting in 2016, and prices under $3.50 a gallon. Has the Navy or the aviation industry weighed in with EPA on the RFS? These are significant amounts.
If they have, we're not aware of it.
Okay, and how about the aviation industry?
I think they filed comments, but I couldn't tell you what they said. You'd have to look at the docket.
Okay, I'll do that. Thank you.
We did have a question come in from the line of Aisha Roscoe.
Hi guys. Thanks for doing this call. I was wondering if you could talk a bit. I mean, have you guys heard any more from the administration? Clearly, they've said that they're going to revise up from the proposal. Steve, I believe it was you, but maybe it was someone else who said they expected substantial revisions. I just wanted to check to see, you know, if you had any details on that, and also to see, you know, are you guys meeting with the White House, kind of what your expectations are?
Yeah, I don't know that we have any specific information on revisions. I think Secretary Vilsack and others in the administration have made some comments, and I'll just let those stand for what they were. You know, we've met with the White House and the OMB in the past. We'll continue to do that going forward as long as the rule is not out. So we're staying very much engaged.
Your next question comes from the line of Jerry Perkins.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's Jerry Perkins, editor of Biofuels Journal here. You seem to indicate in your answers to the questions that the 2014 RVO is almost not important, but the methodology of how the EPA came up with that RVO is really the critical issue here. Do you anticipate litigation, legal action, no matter what the EPA comes up with in its 2014 RVOs, based on what you say was faulty methodology in coming up with that number?
Yeah, this is Brent. Well, I think the oil industry is probably certain to sue, but I think we have to wait and see what methodology they use.
Well, they've already used flawed methodology, according to some of your speakers,
yeah,
and according
true,
to what I'm hearing from other sources.
Yeah, we have to see if they stick to that. But certainly, if they're basing the numbers on the supply of gasoline and not the ability to produce biofuels, I think it's very likely there'll be litigation. And then in terms of the 2014 numbers, part of the reason they don't matter is because we're already in September. So the delay by EPA has kind of made that a moot issue.
It does, where it becomes more important going forward, Steve, is if we look at the 2015 numbers. What we don't want to do is, because if we look at 2015, then we'll have a lot of these plants up and running for a full year, and then it starts having a bigger financial impact on us directly on the plant, but even more importantly on the whole direction, what that brings to expansion, because the plants we're building now is just step one.
Yeah, I think that's a critically important point, that just as the industry is getting its feet under it, we don't want to have the rug yanked from under us. Chris, while we have you on the line, could you talk just a little bit about your plant in Hugoton and the fact that you've got this very complex ecosystem where you're producing conventional cellulosic fuels together along with the power, I think that's a critical story to tell about how cellulosic is standing on the shoulders of conventional fuels, and also about your power generation.
Sure. Just to give a few more details on that, we're using the agricultural residues to obviously fuel the facility as well as to produce the ethanol itself. And the concept is that we will take the residues that are left over of this ag residue after extracting the sugars and fermenting those into ethanol. And the residues there, which is largely a lignin, which is kind of a high energy source, byproduct of the process, will then be utilized to fuel the boiler to produce both electric power and energy for the fuel, or both the steam and the electric power needed to power the plant. So the concept is, and we've already started up and commissioned the cogeneration system, the electric generation system, back in December of last year. So the facility has been operational for a while. The concept is that of that, we're going to use about 1,000 tons of biomass per day in the facility, and about 150 tons will be utilized or will be allocated towards the production of the electricity, and the remainder will be utilized to produce the ethanol itself.
Thanks very much. And Steve, I assume you're doing similar things at your plant.
Yeah, so what we do is produce from the lignin and from the residuals, the sugars and the yeast, we produce biogas that we use, methane, so we use to replace natural gas, and we use that in the cellulosic plant and the corn ethanol plant. And then with a boiler that we burn the lignin, and from that we produce steam that, again, we use both in the cellulosic plant and export to the corn ethanol plant.
Great. I just wanted to make that point because I think it's important that this is not just about advanced biofuels, but it's about a generational change and really modernizing these facilities. Any other questions from people on the phone?
We do have a question from the line of Melody Baumgartner.
Hi, everybody. Congratulations on getting your plants up and running. That's very exciting. I did have a question. We've talked about the so-called blend wall, and to what degree is it important that the E15 rather than E10 standard be stamped official and adopted, or is that just a detail in the larger issue of how much fuel is going to be bought and sold?
Well, Bio doesn't have an official position on the E15, so I'll leave it to Steve or Chris to comment on that.
Well, this is Chris, and I'll start. And, you know, in short, E15 is already stamped as an approved fuel, so that's really not an issue. The only issue in connection with the volumes is, you know, how do you get to those volumes? And frankly, there are multiple ways to get to those volumes. You can use combinations of E85, combinations of E10, E15. Frankly, we just want to give the consumers choice. And if the consumers have a choice at the fuel pump, we're confident that they're going to choose ethanol, which is, you know, higher octane, cleaner, and lower cost. So the bottom line is we just want to give the consumers a choice. And it will be up to them as to, what form of ethanol they utilize, but the infrastructure will be increased. If the EPA issues the correct rule, the infrastructure will be developed to the point that, you know, there will be no problem implementing the only roughly 11% ethanol or something like that on a, basis necessary to implement the rule for the next couple of years.
Thanks very much. Any other questions on the phone?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, that is star one to ask a question.
If not, I'd like to thank all of our speakers today for their presentations. It's very exciting what's happening in the industry, and I'd like to add my congratulations to their success, and thank all the reporters on the line. If you need to follow up, you can call Paul Winters here at Bio, and he can help you out. So thank you, everybody. Have a good day.